So, Professor Richard Thomas, let's start with your reaction to the awarding of the 2016 Nobel Prize for Literature to Bob Dylan. Many critics were unhappy with this. I'm reading from Tim Stanley in the British paper The Telegraph. He said, quote, "A culture that gives Bob Dylan a literature prize is a culture that nominates Donald Trump for president." I guess we have to amend that now to elects Donald Trump. What's your reaction to all of this?
Well, to that juxtaposition, a pretty grotesque one, but I was as delighted as he was unhappy. And it seemed quite natural. A number of us have been talking about this for years. Scholar Gordon Ball has been writing articles about it, and I think the committee finally saw and wonderfully presented in the presentation speech by Professor Engdahl.
The brief mention that I saw in the announcement was that he was being recognized for, quote, having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition.
Right, yeah, that was the initial announcement before the celebration. There's a longer text at the celebration which goes into some of the sources going back to Shakespeare, back to classical languages and literatures. But yeah, basically creating new forms of American song rooted in so much more as well.
So they recognize him as being part of a tradition that goes back, as you said, to Shakespeare and even farther.
Yeah, way back. I mean, to Homer, to Greek lyric poetry. Sappho is a good example. Sappho sang to an accompaniment. We've lost the accompaniment. We've lost the music, so we have the text. But Sappho and Dylan are right there in the same performing tradition. So both performers, both musicians, both poets.
So tell me a bit about the class that you teach on Dylan at Harvard.
Sure, it's just a freshman seminar. I do it every 4 years because it's not exactly... I argue that Dylan belongs in the classics, but he doesn't strictly in terms of the language he uses. So I started thinking in the late 20th century about Dylan as a literary figure who was not unlike the literary figures that I work on from antiquity, in the complexity of his lyrics, in just what he does with language. And so do it as a freshman seminar. There are generally 12 students, and a lot of it is having them present, so having them analyze songs, sort of pick apart lyrics, talk about issues, poetic issues, try and get them away from sort of the autobiographical and the biographical around Bob Dylan, but to look at it as literature, yeah.
How long have you been doing that?
2004 was the first one, so this is our fourth time round in 2016.
What sparked your interest or your desire to begin a class like that?
Well, we were asked to offer more freshman seminars, and so one's less sort of tied to the curriculum in Greek and Latin and classics, so I thought that might be fun too. So met some resistance to begin with, but now it's doing fine.
You must be feeling a bit vindicated then right about now.
That's what people are saying, and the answer is yes, I do.
So how did you relate Bob Dylan to what you normally teach, the classics, going back to Virgil?
Right, well, in 2001 on Love and Theft, Lonesome Day Blues, there are three lines straight out of Virgil's Aeneid. So the singer there is singing about things aren't going well, you know, there are wars, unspecified wars, and they basically are figured through various sort of literary allusions to Twain, to Huck Finn, to a Japanese gangster novel, essentially, so the Sino-Japanese wars in there, and the Roman civil wars and wars of Virgil's epic, the Aeneid, are there too, through those allusions. So that's, you know, that's part of Dylan's art, of course. Is very rarely does he have topical references to places or situations. With God on Our Side, I guess, would be an exception where you get specific wars there, but that's a very deliberate act, the Indian Wars, the Civil Wars, World War One, and so on. So that has a particular reason for doing those, for giving those actual contextual things, but Masters of War can be any war, and I think that's part of Dylan's art, is to create the universal, something that keeps on mattering.
In terms of the lines that you quoted from Virgil, these are deliberate...
The word, rather sort of unappealing word, is intertextuality, basically, the way sort of poets, you can say allusion, you can say reference, but I think the general phenomenon now is called intertextuality. That is the way texts are working in a relationship.
You know. Is that a literary concept, then, intertextuality?
Yeah, it comes from critical theory, from a French scholar. Julia Kristeva is the first who used it. It's used in different ways and now really, I think, without any sort of theoretical specificity, at least by people like myself. Now, you could call it plagiarism. Virgil himself was accused of plagiarism in antiquity, plagiarizing Homer. So, basically you have to separate those who understand what's going on around this process and those who don't, who see it as an impoverishment that the poet can't think up his own words and has to sort of borrow from elsewhere.
That's interesting because I recall from the early days, Dylan has been accused of that.
Of
stealing lyrics from people. And when I was growing up in New Jersey, there was this big rumor that kept spreading that Blowin' in the Wind was actually written by a New Jersey high school student.
Dylan
had taken it.
Right,
so he's been accused of that.
He has. I mean, in that case, the chronology doesn't work out when that his band, the kids' band at school, claimed that they heard it from him first, but that's just because they hadn't heard it from Dylan first, who had done it first.
So that's something else entirely. But what you're saying is that Dylan has been doing this intertextuality.
Right. I mean, there are forms of stealing. So Dave Van Ronk's version of House of the Rising Sun, Dylan apparently sort of heard the arrangement and basically, although asked not to, basically did it. And you can't, once you've given a musician and an artist some art that he can make his own, that's what Dylan went and did. And that's one form, but again, and Dylan talks about this, the blues and folk music, who does that belong to? Each new version, each new iteration is simply a new version. Now, if you then copyright it, as Dylan's been very careful to do himself, then it becomes your property, but then people do covers and so on. So
yes, wasn't there that instance with Hootie and the Blowfish who took the line from Idiot Wind and put it in their song?
Right.
And Dylan, did he actually sue them for that?
I'm not sure. Not sure, but I'm sure letters were written.
So back to Dylan and the classics. Can you fill in for those of us who are ill-informed about actually who these people were? Just generally Virgil, the people that you...
It's a huge question, but basically the genre of epic poetry clearly begins with Homer, at least the first written down text we have are Homer. Drama begins in Athens with both tragedy and comedy. So if you're thinking back from people like Milton's Paradise Lost or Shakespeare, you basically end up with this material, pretty much all of it, a lot of it. So Shakespeare has sort of gone through the late Middle Ages and Renaissance through Italy, and so versions of drama which are being produced in the vernacular, that is, Italian, French, and so on, the languages that come from Latin, so that there's this stream which, without the classical languages, particularly without people like Virgil, without Horace, who's a lyric poet, without Catullus, an earlier lyric poet, there really is no font, there is no sort of spring from which it comes, so it's hard to imagine, how epic poetry would have come about. Of course, people have always sung, so lyric, basically song to the lyre, has been there. The kithara is old, it's Greek, and it's the same word as guitar, same word as zither, so that, music to string instruments, to any number of other sort of early examples of the sort of instrumentation available now are there. So we've lost, at least in the culture at large, we've lost access to, or we've lost the realization of the tradition of the West, and now it's very sort of the Western tradition is seen as sort of hegemonic and therefore bad. But everything comes out of that, including the Romantics, who are pretending that they're not, but they're all, you know, they're all in this tradition that goes back to Greek and Roman poetry. Yeah.
So I would say that in general knowledge, it's well known that Dylan goes back to the folk tradition and roots around in the classic folk from America's 19th century and Civil War and things like that. But to think that he goes so far back and is familiar with those poets, is this something new for him, or is
it's newish. I mean, he doesn't just go back to American song in the 19th century. He goes back to, if you look at Child's great sort of set of volumes on the sort of the ballad and folk traditions, I mean, he goes back to America, to Appalachia and so on, but Appalachia goes back to Scotland and England. And so Samuel Pepys writes in a diary about a ballad that Dylan would then sing in the Gaslight, on the Gaslight album that came out. So that's a song which is even older than the 17th century reference in Pepys. It clearly goes back to the 14th and 15th centuries. So folk song is always there, including in classical antiquity, harvest songs, so working songs, basically field songs, which are, you know, in the folk tradition that the Lomaxes recorded and preserved. You know, humans sing. They sing while they're working, they sing while they're drinking, they sing while they're... and it's not as if that started in the 19th century. It's just that sort of song tends not to be written down in antiquity, because what gets written down is the higher register texts, which are useful for teaching in the schools, that then the sort of sacred texts, the Christian texts, get written down again for purposes of instruction and keeping the sacred book tradition going. But folk disappears unless you, and if, you know, without the Lomaxes, imagine how less rich the American song tradition would be now. It's why Congress in 1976 basically created the Folklore Center in Washington, which is where the Lomax and other materials ended up. So you have to imagine folk versions of folk blues, lullabies, and so on, going back, as far as back in time, In a much more self-conscious way, Dylan started engaging some of these texts, the Greek and Roman texts, in translation, and in some cases you can actually sort of point to the translation that he used, say, of Ovid, and so he started using it in a way that I think is not ultimately different. I think he's always wanted you to recognize the song, the other song that is in his song, but it's in a much more readerly way rather than, though he clearly is reading the Bible, reading American sort of song books in the earlier periods too, so maybe it's just the same, but different texts.
So what do you think, is he incorporating these as he becomes familiar with them himself and sees how they can relate to what he's trying to do?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, his reading has always been interesting. He's always read at will, in a sense. I mean, so scholars and people listening will hear a bit of Rambo there, in the 60s, in the mid-60s, and we'll hear other things at different times. But there is something, I think, more conscious about the albums from 2001 on, from Love and Theft.
That he is concentrating more on his intertextuality, his...
he's using other texts as sort of the building blocks for the stories in the songs which he's creating. Those stories and songs are very different from the source texts that he's using, but the fragments of those source texts sort of bring along meaning, which then is brought out by the Dylan song, if you recognize the source text.
Yes, admirers of Dylan have always said that whatever he steals, he turns into something unique to him.
Yeah.
He reinterprets it. It becomes a piece of art and in his hands.
Right. But and that's true of, you know, it's true of Dante. Dante's sort of borrowing bits of Virgil and, you know, changing the language there. But it's true of Milton. It's true of all of them. I mean, that's how it works, right?
So here's a hard question. Do you have an overall theory of Bob Dylan? And I guess by that I mean some overarching idea that he is doing and has been doing that has attracted you all this time.
I think he just puts words, exquisitely chosen, always just the right word for the sentiment, into musical arrangements which work on you in the most fundamental ways. I mean, whether it's about losing a girlfriend or a parent or a brother in different ways, it just works. And I think it's the combination of the lyric. I mean, people have said this, Christopher Ricks says it best, perhaps, that, you know, it's the words, the music, and the voice, and that particular voice, which is an instrument that Dylan trains, uses, varies, depending on what he's trying to do in the moment, in the performative moment. And that may be different from one night to the next with the same song, which will take on a different meaning depending on whether he changes his tone, whether he draws out a syllable or two, whether he repeats a word.
That has always been a complaint of some people who go to see Dylan.
Right,
I can't tell what he's singing. Yeah, it doesn't sound the same.
Right, and I can't sing along. Yeah, which of course he does partly so people can't sing along. He doesn't spare anyone in terms of providing the expectations that they have. So that's where he differs from other sort of great and durable artists. So people like, I needn't name any, but people who basically go along to give their audience, you know, what they got 30 years earlier when they were 16, and so that will take them back there. Dylan has no interest in doing that. He's interested in the performance of the moment, and you have to meet him there.
I think that's true. I mean, I think he does what he does because he wants to.
Exactly.
He doesn't need the money. He's a relentless performer.
Right.
And has been for years. Mm-hmm. And he's driven to do it himself. And the way he changes everything, I think that's what has meaning for him.
Right, and the way he sort of uses his bands, too. I mean, these great bands that he's had now for 20 years and more.
So people have been obsessed over the years with the meaning of Dylan's songs from the very beginning. I'm thinking back to, what was his name, A.J. Weberman?
Yeah.
Who notoriously went through Dylan's garbage in the village. I think that was back in the 70s.
Late 60s, I guess.
Late 60s, yeah. Trying to...
Well, mid to late, yeah, after Dylan went up to Woodstock, so after the 66 bike crash, if there was a bike crash.
More Dylan legend.
Yeah, well, and Weberman, he's still at it. I mean, he's still...
Oh, is around. He?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's... he now, I think, has a theory that Dylan, in fact, is very conservative, is a racist, and is sort of reading the lyrics in a way that will prove that. So he's an interesting guy, Weberman, but his aim back in the late 60s was, in going through the garbage, or one of them was to sort of find evidence of sort of heroin use that would then explain the lyrics of the mid-60s.
In your class, you play the music and the song entire for the class, and they respond to that. It's not just the lyrics, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, yeah, so I talk a certain amount. I will play, you know, a song that's on some of the, you know, we work through in time. In 2004, we were just getting through the corpus. Well, if you think of what's happened since 2004, we now have to sort of rush things at the end, but we don't get through more than three or four songs and discussion in the two-hour session. So we just read a tiny tip of the iceberg of what Dylan has produced. So, but yeah, a couple of students each class will then take a song, and they'll tend to, you know, depending on their own interests. I've had some very good musicians, including sort of classical musicians, who will talk a lot about sort of chord shifts and try and connect that to what's going on in the lyrics. But we definitely, yeah, any song that is whose lyrics are discussed, we play the entire song, of course, sometimes more than once, maybe in a bootleg version, maybe a cover version, you know, obviously something like All Along the Watchtower doing Henrik's, and then Dylan picking up on Henrik's in his later performances of it.
What are some of the iconic songs that you use in class, or you would just say for yourself, these are the ones that illustrate what is greatest about him?
Yeah, how long do you have?
I know,
that's a question that I can never answer. So I don't. As far as the class goes, I usually have about 12 on the syllabus, about 12 songs for that day, and tell students to listen to that. The students who are assigned to listen to them and pick one that they think is interesting. So so those aren't necessarily canonical ones, but. So I really can't. I mean, I could sit there and I could say, oh, well, Blowing in the Wind and Masters of War and keep on going through Tangled Up in Blue and Sarah and so on. I would like to do a lot more with the post-97 material, or actually starting with Shot of Love in 81 as the sort of third of the so-called Christian group. So coming out of that with, say, a song like Grain of Sand, which, you know, which has Christian as well as Hebrew Bible connections. So like every hair that's numbered, like every grain of sand. But that is that song a Christian song? No, I mean, it's about faith, it's about there being a God of some sort out there, and whatever message is in that sort of beautiful song, basically. So it's a song that matters. And the material then, sort of looking through the 80s as a, you know, the 80s stuff that a lot of people at the time thought was not so good. On any album, really, there are songs which are as great as any. So on Infidels in 83, Joker Man, from the same sessions, Blind Willie McTell, which didn't get put out until Bootlegs 1 through 3 in 91, so that song just sat there for 8 years. Even Empire Burlesque in 85, the song on that, Dark Eyes, which there's also the YouTube you've probably seen of Patti Smith and Dylan doing that, which is pretty, given Patti Smith at the Nobel, that's pretty electrifying. Two, there's a song also, When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky on Empire Burlesque, which I think is just a fantastic song. I prefer the bootleg version that came out a bit later. And yeah, Knocked Out Loaded, that's probably getting down there, but a song like Brownsville Girl is just this wonderful epic poem. Then Oh Mercy in 89 has sort of Shooting Star, and then Series of Dreams, which came out later in Telltale Signs. So again, as with the bootleg versions, these songs that were in the can but which we didn't hear for years after.
That's one thing that critics have noticed about Dylan, is that he seems to write a masterpiece and then leave it off an album, and it's not until years later that somebody discovers it.
Yeah, well, I think the producer, well, I think, I don't know how much Dylan, certainly on some albums, Dylan as producer hasn't been, you know, basically he was under contract, so take another side of Bob Dylan, Tom Wilson is doing it, and Dylan comes down for a session. In that case, they got all the songs on there, but later versions where, you know, they decide, you know, what an LP can fit on it, obviously creates some constrictions. So with Blood on the Tracks, the wonderful outtake Up to Me, which again we didn't hear till, you know, between 1975 when it was, or 74, I think that was probably actually done in the studio, and we don't hear it until 1991. And that was, I gather, left off because it perhaps sounded a bit too much like Shelter from the Storm. So a choice there about, you know, you had to exclude one or the other just because of the time issue.
How do the students react to Dylan, these young people who, to them, this must be just some old guy?
Yeah, well, that I was curious when I first offered it about whether anybody would actually apply for it, but and a bunch did. I mean, some, it's usually a mix of sort of three categories, some who know him really well, usually just two or three or four at the most in each class, and some who know him sort of know the old chestnuts, the obvious ones, and then some who are just curious, maybe because their parents still occasionally, their parents who sort of dropped out from Dylan in, let's say, 65, if they were pure folkies and didn't like the electric guitar, so dropped out in 64, 65. Some who dropped out in 66 when Dylan stopped doing things like a Rolling Stone and was doing, not performing for 8 years, I mean, not on the road. But yeah, so, I mean, when they see, you know, there's so much on YouTube, you know, just seeing the young, sort of sexual, incredibly attractive Dylan on stage is, you know, as I think as attractive to them now. But I also, you know, sort of looking at the older Dylan now who's playing, there's something about not just, I think we were talking about the voice, the lyrics and the words, sorry, the music, the lyrics and the voice, but it's also Dylan himself, I think, the sort of seeing Dylan on stage, whether it activates your memory of that younger Dylan or the various sort of phases of Dylan, or just the appeal of him sometimes sort of doing a vaudeville sort of gesture, or almost sort of back to the carnival roots that he talks about and writes about from his youth. So, and they seem to pick up on that, so it doesn't, I don't detect any, ew, look at that old guy doing, you know, the reaction that the Victoria's Secret ad evoked, you know, people
right.
were just being grossed out, not realizing what Dylan was doing there. Well, who knows what he was doing, but it worked if you, you know, saw that it was Dylan the artist rather than just some old guy eyeing a model.
What do you think of what he's doing now with the American Standards kind of interpretations that he's put out lately?
You mean the Sinatra?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the two Sinatra albums, 2015, Shadows in the Night, and then Fallen Angels in 2016. Yeah, so it took me a while to listening to them just as studio albums, but they're really, I think he did it to take them on the road with him, and that's what he's been doing really for 3 or 4 years. At this phase of his career, he's creating a Sinatra thing, and it works very well with the songs from Tempest in particular, and Together Through Life, the songs from the 2000s.
Yes, it does. I was not impressed with the studio versions of those, but then when I saw him do them,
exactly.
They made sense.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
They made sense,
exactly.
And I was really struck by how he was able to, I guess, manipulate that material to fit with what he was doing.
Right, right. And it's another form of theft. You know, he's basically, you would call it, you know, it was announced, you know, the reviews, Dylan does Sinatra cover. Well, Dylan has actually stolen Sinatra. Because, you know, in concert, those songs aren't Sinatra anymore.
They're
Dylan.
Right, yeah. I wonder what's next for him.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I'd love to see a continuation of the Love and Theft, Modern Times, Together Through Life, Tempest, but, you know, he's just put out this terrific new, the lyrics, 1961 to 2012, and that sort of has a terminal feel to it, 2012, in terms of original albums, but, you know, that's what we thought in 2006, where the, you know, the last line of the last song, he's in at the world's end, and you think, okay, that's it. And
that was Ain't Talkin'?
Yeah, exactly. And that's an Ovid line, too, at the end of that song.
Is it really?
Yeah.
So back we go again.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, something happened in 1997 when Time Out of Mind came out. There was a huge recognition that this was a giant comeback for Dylan. It felt like that anyway. But it seems like since then, at least for me, I've just become far more interested in everything he's doing. It seems like he's experienced some kind of renewed dedication to his art.
Yeah,
that has
really
been reflected in everything that's come since.
Exactly. I mean, and artists have periods where things are percolating, maybe you can call them down periods, but if one of those, if the sort of the 90s, early 90s, in spite of the sort of good songs, great songs at any given album through that period, did something happened with 97, I think you can see I'm practicing for it in the two covers, Good As I've Been To You in 91 and World Gone Wrong 92, so folk and blues. But then, you know, you go from Under the Red Sky, where, you know, you might have one Born in Time as a great song there. A lot of these songs aren't coming out until Telltale Signs, but you go from that to Time Out of Mind, where there's not a single song that you would get rid of or not want on there, and it doesn't even have Things Have Changed and Red River Shore, two songs that, again, you don't get until Telltale Signs. So something about the art is happening there. I think it's also something about the bands that he's using and that he's working with.
What was the song that you first noticed the Virgil lines in?
That's in Lonesome Day Blues, yeah. And I wasn't the only one, but I, you know, that album came out on 9/11, 2001. So I didn't actually listen to it for a few days. But then there were a couple of graduate students who were also Dylan fans, and I think we just emailed pretty much at the same moment and said, hey, Bob's singing Virgil, which, you know, for one of them who was doing his dissertation on Virgil, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I can imagine. I saw him in Boston November of that year, and he did that song.
Yeah.
I did seem to notice that he changed the lyrics in it, but I don't know what he changed them to. I've been trying to find out since.
For that verse?
For that song. I can't remember the exact verses in it, but okay. He did change. And whenever he does that, it's always significant, I think. And if you can find out what he's changed it to, then you have even more of an insight.
Right, and the lyrics, you know, the official lyrics, the three over the years, the three sort of sets of them put out by Bob Dylan's people, also are interesting and seem to be, I don't know, sort of sometimes even concealing something that was there before. At the same time, I mean, Ain't Talkin', there's a version of that on Telltale Signs, which has next to no Ovid on it. So, you know, which came first? And of course, I think he's, you know, just as he continued to be booed, you know, through those 2 years in 65, 66, and because he knew what he was doing was right, he knows also, you know, what he's doing with using other texts is what an artist and what he in particular is doing. So I don't think changes of that sort are to somehow sort of cover up for something that anyway is out there on millions of CDs and YouTubes and so on.
Have you ever met him?
No.
Would you like to?
Yeah, sure. no, I would. Yeah, I mean, what would you say? I mean, maybe talk about baseball or something.
Right, yeah. Because I guess you wouldn't expect to be able to ask him anything directly and find out, you know.
Exactly.
What were you
thinking? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the interviews that he, of course, controls are always very interesting. You know, and he has particular individuals that he will use for releasing particular bits of information or initiating particular conversations. So.
Is he coming out with another Chronicle?
That's the word, of course, and that's the, you know, volume one implies that, and yeah, occasionally there are mentions of it. I mean, it would sure be interesting. I mean, what didn't get covered, the Christian period in Chronicles Volume 1 and various other interesting periods. I don't think, you know, I think that basically if we got another volume, I would be pleasantly surprised, not too surprised. If we don't, then I won't be surprised. Yeah, but it's a great book. So let's hope.
All right. Well, I have run out of questions. Is there anything you would like to add to this discussion?
No, it's been fun talking about Dylan, and the news about the Nobel was great, and his acceptance speech, which was read out by the American ambassador to Sweden, was again a gem of a Dylan production.
And we got a performance from Patti Smith.
Yeah, amazing, and amazing almost because of the lapse rather than in spite of it.
Yeah, she forgot some words, or says that actually she didn't forget them, she just couldn't get them out.
Right, yeah, I think the moment, the occasion, and I mean, yeah, I don't blame.
Now, there's something else he's supposed to do as part of this ritual, right? Give a lecture?
Yeah, I think he's supposed to give a lecture. I guess as literature has been redefined in the minds of some, so maybe a version of Brownsville Girl, which went on for 20 minutes, could be a lecture.
So maybe
in some performance. He is going to Scandinavia and Stockholm on next April, I think it is.
April, it's May. So he might incorporate something to do with that.
Exactly. And so this tour was announced, I think, actually before the Nobel. He's going to Wales and other parts of the UK, and then I think, or maybe it's the other way around, but anyway, yeah, he's definitely going to be in Stockholm. So,
well, we'll have to see.
Yeah.
Well, Richard Thomas, thank you so much for talking to me this morning. It's been a great pleasure.
A pleasure for me too, and nice to meet you, Chuck.